Now, we're going to be looking into the Psalms again this morning, and it's Psalm 14. We've been talking about the heart, and it's a very, very important subject. And this Psalm, once again, talks about the heart. The important thing we have to realize is that there's the outside of people and there's the inside of people. And what goes on the outside is not always the same as what is going on the inside. And God is very interested in what is going on the inside. And we call that the heart, the inner person. And so we're going to spend a few weeks looking into the Psalms to find out some things that we can learn about the secrets of the heart. Now, this particular psalm, it seems a bit gloomy at first, but we'll see that it isn't gloomy so much as realistic. And it's a psalm about somebody who has a real concern about what he sees. So let me read Psalm 14 to you. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt, their deeds are vile, there is no one who does good. The Lord looks down from heaven on the sons of men to see if there are any who understand, any who seek God. All have turned aside, they have become together corrupt. There is no one who does good, not even one. Will evildoers never learn, those who devour my people as men eat bread and who do not call on the Lord? There they are, overwhelmed with dread, for God is present in the company of the righteous. You evildoers frustrate the plans of the poor, but the Lord is their refuge. Oh, that salvation for Israel would come out of Zion. When the Lord restores the fortunes of his people, let Jacob rejoice and Israel be glad. Now, I think the key to this psalm is found in the smallest word in the psalm, or one of the smallest words in the psalm. It's the small word with which verse 7 begins, O-H, O. Now, you can say O in a variety of ways. Somebody can be explaining something to you, and you say, O. Or you can show real interest, and you say, O. Or you can get all excited about it and say, oh. And I don't think he's saying, oh, or oh, or oh. Do you know what I think he's saying? I think he's saying, oh. Excuse me, I didn't intend to wake you. I do apologize. He feels something very deeply here. Oh. You know the problems that we have in our culture at the present time? People don't feel deeply. They don't get really concerned. I remember when I was singing in the choir in England many years ago, the ladies were practicing and the men were talking quietly while the ladies were practicing. And the tenor sitting next to me said to me, I sang in a musical festival last Saturday. These were sort of musical competitions that we used to sing in. Sometimes the whole choir, sometimes a quartet, sometimes just solos. And this man said that he'd sung in the lyric tenor class. I said, how did it go? Terrible. He said, absolutely terrible. So I said, well, why? What was wrong? Well, he said, it was about 50 miles away. My car broke down, so I had to go on the bus. There was no heating on the bus. I didn't have time to get my breakfast. They had me sing at 9 o'clock in the morning. Tenors don't like singing at 9 o'clock in the morning. He said, the preliminary rounds of the competition were held in an old schoolhouse. He said, I had to sing in a little classroom. There were only two people in the classroom. One was the elderly pianist, and the other one was an equally elderly adjudicator, judge. And he said, I had to sing a Neapolitan love song. He said, frozen cold, hungry, in this dilapidated building to these old, decrepit folks, I had to sing a Neapolitan love song. He said, he listened to me, and at the end, he wrote two words on his sheet, adjudicating me. I said, what were the two words? He said, lacks passion. Lacks passion. Passion. Now, that's understandable. What is hard to understand is why so often people lack passion about things that really matter. Somebody has said that the Church of Jesus Christ resembles a banker's dinner, cold and correct, decorous and dead. And yet sometimes you will get people who do get enthused about things, and we call them fans. Let me explain something to you. I was horrified to discover the other day that 80% of people in the United States of America do not know the country in which the World Cup will be held. Now, I'm not going to ask if anybody here does not know where the World Cup is going to be held. Some of you don't even know what the World Cup is. The World Cup is the biggest sporting event in the world. It is when the international teams from countries all over the world play in the finals of football. Let me explain football. Football is a game where people apply the foot to the ball, in marked contrast to a game in America that bears a similar name, where it is only on the fourth down when nothing else works that they apply a foot to the ball. And usually, more often than not, they bring someone in from Europe to do that as well. Now, you need to understand, the national team of the United States of America is going to be playing in this competition, and they will need support. They will need tremendous encouragement, because between you and me, they don't stand much of a chance. Now, if you go to a football game, there are certain ways of showing support. Unfortunately, there's an English football team here in the area this weekend, and they brought me some of the things that are necessary for football support. And so I'm going to demonstrate to you a little enthusiasm. This is the hat of Manchester United, the greatest football team in the world, which I have supported for many years and haven't seen for 25 years. This is the scarf that you wear when you go to a football game. You do not stand there politely. You get into it. You get excited. And when something really exciting happens, you take off your scarf and you wave it around and you do it with all the rest of the crowd. And it's called enthusiasm. It's called passion. It's called passion. Now, let me ask you something. When it comes to spiritual issues, as they relate to our world at this present time, have you got a polite, oh? Or do you have a heart-rending, oh, oh, that the salvation for Israel will come out of Zion. Now, there are two concerns here that the psalmist has. Because of the conditions in which he is living, first of all, he is concerned about what is happening to the people of God in those conditions. And he's saying with a tremendous heartfelt passion, oh, that God would do something for his people. But at the same time, we've got to recognize that God needs to be breaking out into these societies and cultures to do what only He can do. And He chooses to do it through His people. And what He's looking for is a great, big, heartfelt, oh. Now let's see what it was that was concerning the psalmist. You'll notice the opening words of this psalm are, "The fool says in his heart, there is no God." He's addressing a human problem. He's saying that the essence of the human dilemma is found in the heart of the individual. Hear me. He's saying that the essence of the human dilemma is found in the heart of the individual. He goes on to show that if the heart is wrong, relationships will be wrong. If relationships are wrong, society will be wrong. If society is wrong, culture will be wrong. I would submit to you that there is not a person in this room right now who does not recognize there is something fundamentally wrong with our society, fundamentally wrong with our culture. We've got massive problems. The politicians are talking about it. The sociologists are talking about it. They are thinking of all kinds of ways of addressing the situation. We're looking for the government to do something. We're looking for the president to do something. We're looking for money to throw at these problems. We are recognizing that there are vast societal and cultural problems. What the Bible says uniquely is this, that the root of these problems is in the individual human heart. Many, many people don't want to admit that. Many people don't want to admit that in the human heart there's fundamentally a spiritual problem. that at the root of our vast sociological problems, there is a fundamental spiritual issue that needs to be addressed. What the psalmist is saying really gets to him is that people are saying in their hearts, there is no God. Now, this applies two ways. First of all, of course, you can have the person who is the philosophical atheist. That is the person who would agree with somebody like Herbert Spencer, who said the infinite cannot be known by the finite. Or in other words, it is impossible to know if there is a God, therefore we may as well assume there isn't a God. It is utterly impossible for human beings to understand and grapple with God. The infinite cannot be known by the finite. Herbert Spencer, with all due respect, was overlooking one thing, and that is that if the infinite chooses to reveal himself to the finite, then it is perfectly possible for the infinite to be known by the finite. The problem, however, is more important than that. That there are many, many people who have come to the conclusion, functionally, that there is no God. The amazing thing about it is this. The people who arrive at that conclusion are overlooking the fact that they are going in with an article of faith. You see, there are two kinds of people in the world. There are those who believe that God is, and there are those who believe that God isn't. Both are articles of faith. You cannot prove that God does not exist. You cannot say categorically there is no God for a very obvious reason. The only person who can say there is categorically no God is the person who knows everything. And in the everything that they know that God does not exist. Then, of course, they could say there's no God. But who knows everything? And there's some very smart people here today, and I'm totally intimidated. Who among us here knows everything? 100% of all knowledge. You have to be smart to know everything because the data bank of knowledge doubles every 6 months now. So it's hard to keep up, smart as we are. Let's back off a bit. Who knows 1% of all knowledge here? Well, who knows a fraction? Let's assume that everybody here knows 1% of all knowledge. That means we don't know 99% of all there is to know. Here's the question. It's a very obvious question. If we freely admit that we don't know 90% of everything there is to know, is it possible that God exists in the 99% of all that we don't know? And the answer to that is obviously yes. Therefore, we do not take seriously anybody who says categorically, there is no God. We don't want to get into a philosophical debate with them because we're more concerned than that. We're more concerned of the fallout of the people who live on this premise, there is no God. They are deeply, deeply troubled people. Let me explain to you why. If there is no God, there is no creator. If there is no creator, you were not created. If you are not created, there is no intelligent purpose or reason behind your existence. If there's no intelligent purpose or reason behind your existence, there is no reason why anybody should regard you as significant. There is no reason why anybody should treat you with dignity. If there is no God, anything goes. Many, many people who've been operating on the basis, either philosophically or functionally, that there is no God, have come to the point of unrelieved despair. They really don't have any option because when they look at their lives, they see no rhyme, no reason, no purpose for their existence. Ernest Hemingway, the great novelist who eventually committed suicide, he said, "Life is just a dirty trick from nothingness to nothingness." Well, at least he was honest. Because if there is no God, there's no creator. If there is no creator, there is no reason for your existence. But more than that, if there is no God, there's no judge. If there is no judge, there's no final evaluation of your life. If there's no final evaluation of your life, what you do has no ultimate significance. If what you do has no ultimate significance, then why bother what you do or what you don't do? If it doesn't matter what you do or don't do, it doesn't really matter if you are or you aren't. It's very difficult to really get serious about people who have no creator because, you see, they are simply going from nothingness to nothingness. And they're left with a sense of emptiness. They're left with a sense of feeling that they have been cheated. Boris Becker, the youngest man ever to win the singles title, tennis at Wimbledon, said, "I had it all." He said, "I had the fame." He said, "I had the money. I had the cars. I had the women. I had absolutely everything. But I had no inner peace. I was only a puppet on a string." Jack Higgins, the author of many, many novels, including the famous one, The Eagle Has Landed, said, in answer to a question one day, he was asked, "Now you're a man, was there anything you wish you'd been told when you were a boy that you now know?" And he said, "Yes." And they said, "What is it?" He said, "I wish they'd told me when I was a boy that when you get to the top, there's nothing there. When you get to the top, there's nothing there." Gertrude Stein said, "When you get there, there's no there there. When you get there, there's no there there." What's the matter with these people? Oh, they're simply taking the no God philosophy to its logical conclusion. They're thinking the thing through and they're discovering a vast void in their lives. And when you hear this, what do you say? Oh. What do you say? Oh. What do you say? Oh. Oh, that the salvation of God would come out to these people. But you'll notice, of course, that this psalmist actually is not so much concerned about people who say there is no God. He is concerned about people who say in their hearts there is no God. The difference here. The person who says openly, belligerently, aggressively there is no God is a philosophical atheist. The person who says in his heart there is no God is not a philosophical atheist. There wouldn't be any philosophical atheist in the covenant people that David was addressing here. But there would be functional atheists. In other words, they would not come to the intellectual conviction there was no God, but they would treat God not as if he did not exist. They would treat him as if he was an irrelevance to their lives. Do you know anybody like that? Do you know anybody who is a functional atheist, who says in his heart, but doesn't say it out loud, "As far as the practical import of this life of mine is concerned, as far as being a human being here on earth is concerned, God is an utter irrelevance. Whether he exists or does not exist is of no interest to me. His commands are of no concern to me. His promises are of no concern to me. His offer of salvation is of no interest to me. His people are of no interest to me. Worship is of no interest to me. Prayer is something that is of no interest to me." He says in his heart, there's no God. The problem for that person very often is that he is not being strictly honest with what is going on in his life. One remarkably honest person who was in that position was the famous British philosopher Aldous Huxley. Incredibly, this is what he said. "I had motives for not wanting the world to have a meaning. Consequently, assumed it had none, and was able without any difficulty to find satisfying reasons for this assumption. For myself, the philosophy of meaningless was essentially an instrument of liberation, both sexual and political." Now, what's he saying there? He's saying that he had reasons for not wanting there to be a God. Because if there was a God, he would put some restrictions on him. He would be accountable. He would be responsible. If there was a God, he could not be his own God. And he didn't want that to happen. He wanted to be his own God. He wanted total freedom in every area of his life. He didn't want anybody exercising authority over his life. That was the heart reason. Because of that, because he didn't want there to be a God, he said it was very, very easy for him to come to the conclusion there wasn't one. And once he'd come to that conclusion, he said he had no difficulty at all looking at, for good reasons that bolstered his argument, like the problem of pain, the problem of evil, all the diversity of religions. They can't all be wrong. They can't all be right. Maybe they're all wrong. Maybe none of it makes sense at all. What a tragedy it is when we find people who are living functionally as if God is an irrelevance. Why should we be concerned? Well, notice the second half of verse 1. We're still in verse 1, I'm sorry. The fool says in his heart, there's no God. They are corrupt, their deeds are vile, there is no one who does good. Now, that is hyperbole. That is a very, very dramatic statement. Let me put it in terms that may make a lot of sense to us in our situation today. Here it is. If we operate on the basis, either functionally or philosophically, that God either does not exist or is an irrelevance, if we operate on that basis, number one, we have to recognize we have nothing to protect us from moral corruption. There is something called evil in the world. Not too many people argue about that now. If they do, show them videotape of Rwanda. 500,000 people murdered by their own people in the matter of a few days. Nobody really argues about the fact that there is evil in the world. What they argue about very often is this, that the evil in the world is purely societal. But as far as I'm concerned, societies are made exclusively of people. And the evil is in the human heart. Now then, if there is evil in the human heart, if I'm capable of unspeakable evil, and I am, if in relationships we're capable of doing desperate things to each other, and we are, if collectively we produce a culture and a society that is capable of degeneration and disintegration, and we have, then what is going to stem the tide of these corrupting influences if we take God out of the picture? When you think about that, what do you say? Oh. Look at the second thing here. He goes on to say they are corrupt, their deeds are vile. If there is a corrupting influence in the human heart, then it is no surprise, of course, that we then begin to engage in activities that are wrong. But if God is taken out of the picture, who decides what is wrong? Who determines what is moral? Who determines what is immoral? We have basically decided that truth is relative, that there are no absolutes, and that therefore it is entirely up to the individual to do whatever they wish to do. And it's nobody else's business. Now, everybody knows who's thinking about it that a society and a culture survives because there are things they hold in common. There are beliefs which they adhered to collectively. There are principles upon which they're agreed. Where are we today? Why do we have disintegration? Why do we have fragmentation? Because there was a time when there was at least tacit acceptance that when it says, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not lie, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not covet, that they were absolute truths and you stuck with them and that was where you agreed and that was what you agreed on. And what do we have now? Now, if you take God out of the reckoning, we not only have the problem of nothing stemming corruption, we also have the problem of nothing defining morality. And he goes on to say this, they're corrupt, their deeds are vile, there is no one who does good. We have nothing to determine what is intrinsically, innately good and right and true, and we do not have the power or the desire to do it. And I would suggest to you that Psalm 1, this ancient, ancient, ancient psalm, is as up-to-date as today's newspaper. What does the Church of Jesus Christ say? Oh. Or does there come from the depths of our heart a great big, oh. Oh, that the salvation of God would come out of Israel. Well, we read on, because now we see the heavenly perspective. Verse 2, you thought we'd never get there. Verse 2, the Lord looks down from heaven on the sons of men to see if there are any who understand and any who seek God. And then he goes on to explain what he's saying. Did you know that there is a divine perspective on the human problem? Were you aware that heaven is observing what is going on? That is encouraging, and it is scarifying. It is encouraging to know that God has his eye on what is going on. The whole thing is not hopelessly out of control. But it is scarifying because he looks on the heart. He looks on the heart. And he sees what is going on there. He sees the root causes of the individual dysfunctional activities. He sees the root causes of the societal disintegration. He sees the root causes of the corrupting of a culture. And he sees it in the human heart. He doesn't just observe it, he evaluates it too. Now, to evaluate anything, you need criteria of evaluation. And the criteria of evaluation are twofold in this psalm. Number one, God is looking for people who understand, and he's looking for people who seek after God. Listen to what the book of Proverbs says. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. The Bible talks in the Old Testament about folly and wisdom and fools and wise. Fools aren't stupid people. They're not dumb people. It doesn't say only stupid people, only dumb people say in their hearts there's no God. No, the fool is the person who chooses not wisdom. And wisdom is predicated on the fear of the Lord, the acknowledgement, the reverence, the commitment to, the submission to the Lord. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. And God looks down from heaven into the human heart, and do you know what he sees? He sees that people don't know the Holy One. He sees that people do not fear the Lord. He sees that people do not operate on the basis of glad submission to and willing obedience to and loving fellowship with the Lord. He sees in the heart that that is not there. And he says, there's the problem. That is what is going on. That is what is leading to the problems that we're confronting in our culture. But that's not all. He goes on to say, there's none who seek after God. That for some strange reason, many, many people will just stay in that situation. They may look for God who will sort of come into their lives and help out a bit. They may look for God who'll come and fix a problem they've got. They may look for God to make them feel a bit better, but they're not looking for God to be God, because they want to be their own gods. At least Aldous Huxley was honest about this. At least he was straightforward about it. He said that was the issue as far as I was concerned. I didn't want there to be a God, because if there was a God, he'd have to be God. And we see stemming from this hard attitude all kinds of problems and all kinds of issues. We can say, oh. Or we can respond as the psalmist does. However, the two things we must never forget that are hinted at in this psalm, well, more than hinted at, mentioned almost casually in the psalm. Notice very carefully what he says in verse 5. God is present in the company of the righteous. Evildoers frustrate the plans of the poor, but the Lord is their refuge. Notice two things. The Lord is present in the company of the righteous. There's a glimmer of hope. The Lord is the refuge of those who turn to him. There's another glimmer of hope. You see, if there is a root spiritual problem, there can only be fundamental spiritual answers. You're not going to get government answers to spiritual problems. You're not going to get legislative responses to the human heart. Now, government and legislation clearly have their place, but the Church of Jesus Christ alone is going to be the means of addressing the issues, the secrets of the heart. It is in the heart that the man has said there is no God. And the great good news is this: God is resident in his people. Do we believe it or don't we? Do we honestly, genuinely believe that the living God from whom people are turning, the living God whom people are ignoring and rejecting and maneuvering into a position of irrelevance, do we believe that this God, regarded by many, many people as a totally irrelevant, is alive and well in his church? And do we believe that he is a refuge for his people? That men and women can come from all the heartache and the pain and the disintegration and disorientation of their lives and find in him, through Christ, that which will make their lives make sense. The irony of it is this: that so many of the people out there in our culture are in deep dread. That's what he says in verse 5. There they are, overwhelmed with dread. A deep sense of insecurity. The psychologists call it angst. When they're not quite sure what to do, they throw in a German word. Angst means anxiety personified. Alistair McGrath, an Oxford theologian, defines angst as follows. See if this resonates with anybody you know. Angst is anxiety about losing our way in the vastness of an impersonal world and being reduced to cosmic insignificance. It may even be sheer despair at the bewildering things that threaten to reduce us to nothing more than a statistic, and ultimately a mortality statistic. Angst. And out there in all the angst, and out there in all the disintegration, out there in all the disorientation, fundamentally coming because of a heart attitude that is rejecting God or regards him as irrelevant, we see the results. And in the midst, God has his people. And in the midst of his people, God lives. And he's inviting men and women and boys and girls to come and find a refuge in him. The Church of Jesus Christ, I believe, is God's answer to what is going on in our world at the present time. And fortunately, the Church of Jesus Christ all too often can be cold and correct, decorous and dead, rather than having a passion for God and a passion for our world and a passion for lostness and a passion to see the good news of the gospel getting out. May I ask you a question? After you hear this psalm, after you think of this psalm, what kind of an oh do you use as a response? Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, yeah, that's bad. Oh, which is it? Let's pray together. I'm going to pray two prayers. The first one would be the kind of prayer that somebody could pray who says, basically, I've been operating on this no-God philosophy. That's how my life has been. The second one is going to be a prayer where we say, I'm a member of God's people, but I must admit that there's been little passion there for the things of God. Let's pray together. Make whatever prayer is helpful your prayer. Dear Lord, I haven't talked to you for a long time. You have been functionally irrelevant. But I'm here now and I fully recognize I have a heart problem. I fully recognize that this is affecting my behavior. I recognize that this is making an impact on my relationships. I recognize that this is all contributing to our societal problems. I've never really thought about it being a spiritual problem, a problem between you and me. I've thought it was emotional. I thought it might be physical. thought it might be societal. I've looked for emotional help. I've looked for societal changes. I've even had a physical checkup. All of these things valid, but I've been ignoring the fact that in my heart I've been regarding you as an irrelevance. And I'm sorry. I would ask you graciously, for Christ's sake, to forgive me. I would ask you, by your Spirit, to take away my heart of stone. Give me a heart of flesh that pulsates with the pulses of your heart, that beats to your heartbeat. I fully recognize I have a long way to go. But I also know that the Chinese say that the longest journey begins with the first step. Taking first steps. Thank you for hearing my prayer. Here's another prayer. Lord, I'm very orthodox. I'm very correct. I think I've got my theology right. I think I behave myself reasonably well. But I lack passion. Quite frankly, I can get more excited over a sporting event than I can about you. I get more worried about a deer that's run over on the road or a whale that's stuck in the ice than I'm concerned about people who are living without God, without Christ, and without hope. And my prayer is that you will touch my heart and do whatever is necessary there to take away the coldness and the hardness and make my heart burn with concern and desire to honor you and to serve you and to be a means of blessing wherever you send me. Thank you for hearing this prayer. Lord, hear our prayers and let our cries ascend unto you in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.